thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's July 2021, and this is episode 246, which is a conversation about the Japanese anime series Dr. Stone. Today's guest is Harrison Dunlin, who is a PhD candidate in cell, molecular, and developmental biology at the University of California, Riverside. He hosts the monthly podcast, Notable Nobels, which covers Nobel Prize winners in physiology or medicine. Harrison has written an article in our print edition of the Christian Research Journal. It is in volume 44, number 2, in our Postmodern Realities column. And his article is called A Martyr of Science, A Reflection on the Anime Dr. Stone. And you can read his article when you subscribe to the Christian Research Journal at equip.org. Harrison, it's good to have you on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Well, as I mentioned, Harrison has written an article for us about a particular anime series, a Japanese anime series called Dr. Stone, in our Postmodern Realities column. And we only have one other podcast and article on anime. And so if listeners would like to read about that and listen to it, you can go back into the archives and find that. We cover various different anime series, but not this one. And so, you know, anime is very popular in pop culture. There's a lot of young people, I'd say a lot of millennials, a lot of Gen Z people watch anime and are introducing it even to their parents. And so it's not just in the United States, it's gone worldwide. So it's really interesting, though, because anime, you know, comes out of Japan and it has certain themes to it that are not Christian. So I guess a lot of Christians would say in the first place, well, why should Christians even watch anime? And like I mentioned, particularly because Japanese anime has, you know, very Eastern spirituality types of themes woven in it. And there is a little bit of that in this particular one in early episodes.
Yeah, so it was sort of like two questions there that I see. So the first is kind of like, why should Christians even watch TV, period, whether it's anime or American television or British sitcoms or whatever? And then the second question is, why should Christians watch something that specifically like has these Eastern spirituality elements to it, right? So I think it'd be helpful for people to know that anime is incredibly diverse. Like, we're talking about a genre that has thousands of different shows. They've been making it for decades now. And so as a genre, anime specifically, like you said, the Japanese animation studios produce these shows, and they have like a very specific art style. Most anime are based off of Japanese graphic novels called manga or manga. And so they have this very distinctive art style to them. But beyond that, anime can be about literally anything and everything. They can cover every single genre that we have. So sci-fi, fantasy, drama, horror, romance, comedy, action, adventure, like it's all there. It's all encompassed in anime. So yeah, trying to like lump them all together is kind of tricky because there's so much of it and it covers such a wide range of different topics. And so that's why I think it might be better to like just say like, why should Christians watch TV specifically as opposed to just anime, because anime has so much diversity to it, like probably more diversity than American television series. And so if you ask the question to Christians, like, why should Christians even watch TV? Like, you're going to get a huge range of responses because Christians all have different opinions about that and where people fall on the lines of like what's appropriate and what's not. So personally, I think just like American television, the vast majority of anime is probably garbage and not worth your time because there is so much there. And they're all, the shows are very, very different and they all have very different themes and messages and topics. And so probably the vast majority of anime is not worth people's time, just like with American television. But there are some things that I think people can appreciate from anime. But even with those, it's not like something I'm saying like people necessarily have to watch. I'm not going to tell people they should watch anime, even because I know that there's going to be some people who would benefit from it while other people probably wouldn't. Especially because like there's different genres of anime that are geared towards specific genders or specific age groups. So it's not like everybody's going to get the same thing out of one particular show or not. But yeah, like everything else, though, I think, you know, Christians should judge each series by the Bible and by what the messages that are being put out there. And when I do that personally, I do see certain themes in anime and certain characters that I can appreciate. There are many anime with main characters who possess Christ-like qualities, like their pursuit of their lost friends, their self-sacrifice for others. And when I see those qualities on TV, you know, I learned to love those things that they represent, and I learned to love the one who modeled them perfectly, our Savior, right? That's sort of like teasing apart which animes you should judge, like animes just in general. You should be careful, like, which ones you watch specifically, but there is some good qualities there. As for the Eastern spirituality question particularly, most of that Eastern spirituality that comes across in anime is taking place inside this realm of fantasy or fiction. So sort of like the way we have like magic in Disney, right? It's like everyone kind of knows this is like fantasy, or like magic in Harry Potter, like that whole sort of debate that goes on within Christian circles, right? It's like, it's that kind of like, it's this fantasy realm. So even as the spirituality is portrayed, there's kind of like woven in alongside alien invasions and being trapped inside a video game and like all the other crazy things that happen in anime. So it works its way in the way like Western philosophy works its way into our American television shows. It's not like the main focus. It's not there. It's like you can filter it out and you can brush it off sort of as like encompassed in this fictional world. At least that's what I do. If other people can't, that's fine. They don't have to watch it. But yeah, again, the Eastern spirituality thing is not universal. In the anime that I wrote the article about, Dr. Stone, the main character, Senku, he has this totally scientific, naturalistic outlook on life, which is a very Western trait, not necessarily Eastern. So the shows are very different. One anime to another are going to have very different themes, very different topics. So I would just tell people to judge each show on its own, not to generalize, and just filter everything by what you know from scripture. And I think that'd be fine.
You mentioned that some anime series are based on graphic novels, manga, and I want to mention to our listeners that we have an article from the Christian Research Journal about manga and also a sidebar article that goes into a specific series, but you can find that on our website, equip.org. It's Manga's Theological Reflection, and then the episode where we talked about anime's spiritual depth is episode 104, if anyone listening is interested or they're new to this podcast and they missed that particular episode. So why don't you tell us a little bit specifically about this anime program, which is called Dr. Stone. What is it about?
Yeah, so Dr. Stone takes place in sort of this post-apocalyptic scenario right at the beginning of the series. And just, spoilers for everybody. We're going to talk about the show. But there's an event that happens on a global scale where the entire world's population is turned to stone, very mysteriously. And that includes all the main characters in the story. And so the main character is this high schooler named Senku, who's a boy genius, Einstein-type character, just absolutely brilliant beyond like what is sometimes considered plausible. But it helps make the story go on. But the world is frozen in stone for thousands of years, actually. Everybody is trapped in stone. And then at the beginning of the series, in the first episode, you realize somebody manages to get out, and it's Senku's friend, Taiju. And so he breaks out and realizes Senku has been able to break out of his stone state as well. But they're in this post-apocalyptic world where they're like the only people that they know of who have managed to free themselves from the stone. And so Senku is there trying to like rebuild civilization from scratch, basically. And along the way, as he figures out a way to break the stone curse on people using the power of science, because that's his thing. And so he starts bringing back people, his friends, people he knew in the area near where everyone was frozen, to sort of rebuild society, rebuild civilization using the power of science, because Senku is this boy genius, Einstein-like character. And so one of the main characters that he brings back right away is a guy named Tsukasa. And Tsukasa is, unlike Senku, he's this might makes right type person rather than like scientifically focused. He's all muscle, but not necessarily lacking brains. He does have a philosophical outlook on life, but that philosophy is very antagonistic to what Senku believes. So Tsukasa's view is we shouldn't bring back science science was responsible for so many of the world's problems for so long. And so that puts him into direct conflict with Senku, and that creates a lot of the drama in the show. So that's kind of like the general setup for the show. There's the Senku on the one hand, working to bring back science, bring back civilization, and Tsukasa is the antagonist there trying to stop him, which works its way out for the whole first season of the show. The main thing that I was focused on in the article was this confrontation that happens between Senku and Tsukasa that works its way to it kind of early in the first season. Basically, Tsukasa confronts Senku and he says, like, will you promise me, like, here and now, for all eternity, you'll just abandon science? And if you do, then I won't have to kill you, but I'm willing to kill you to stop you from bringing back science. And Senku's reply is, well, I can't do that. Tsukasa then looks at Senku, and with a sad smile, he deals a blow to him to break his neck. The episode ends. People are like, oh my gosh, what happened? But then you get to the next episode and you realize Senku has actually survived the blow. And so he lives to continue his science. But seeing Senku sort of die as this martyr for science really got me interested in, really piqued my curiosity and my creative juices, I guess, because I was like, he's dying as like this martyr for science, right? He's being killed for his science, right? And so I was like, that kind of strikes home for me a little bit because I am a scientist. I've been working on my PhD for 5 years now. And so that kind of like raised the question to me, like, is this thing I've been working on, is this science that I do, is that worth dying for? So that was sort of like the setup for the show and where I was at and how I kind of got involved in it.
You're listening to episode 246 of the Postmodern Realities podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is Harrison Dunlin, who has written a print article for our Postmodern Realities column in volume 44, number 2 of the Christian Research Journal. His article is called Martyr of Science, a reflection on the anime Dr. Stone. And you can read his article when you subscribe to the journal at equip.org for $33.50 if you are not currently a subscriber. Now, you've heard me mention for the last few weeks our contest that we're running through the end of this year, and that is to help people find our content on Apple Podcasts by writing a review for us, specifically a print review, a few sentences that you could do for us, because everyone that does that after July 1st of this year through the end of the year, your username will be put into a randomized drawing and you will be able to possibly win a gift subscription for yourself, extend your subscription that you already have by another full year's issues, or give it to a friend or your pastor if you already currently subscribe. And so if you could just go on to Apple Podcasts, search for Postmodern Realities and write a really quick one or two sentence review about why you listen to this show, it would be very helpful because the goal is to get to 100 reviews. Now, if you don't have time for that and just want to help us get to 100 reviews and just put a starred review in there, we would be very grateful. So that's the goal, to run this contest by getting to 100 reviews by the end of this year. And another way you can help us out is simply tell a friend. Just keep spreading the word about the Postmodern Realities podcast on any of your social media feeds. Share some of your favorite episodes. Let people know about this podcast. And if you don't have money in your budget right now to subscribe to the journal, but would like to give us a small tip to help us continue to bring you this podcast, you can tip us very easily at equip.org under magazine, hit Postmodern Realities podcast in the drop-down menu, and there's a link on any one of our episode landing pages. So thank you for partnering with us.
You are just talking about this particular conflict with two of the main characters that got you thinking about just the theme of your article. And you had mentioned that this character, Tsukasa, thinks that the way the world was before it got turned to stone was bad, specifically adults. He talks about mentioning, like, well, adults started wars and things like that. So all the stone statues of adults should be destroyed and not actually be revived. And so you mentioned that he's very much against Senku science and feels that, you know, allowing this science to return, specifically Senku thinks everyone should come back, is going to destroy this, you know, chance at having this Eden of this new world and only basically reviving young people who are worthy of it. So that's kind of in contrast that you mentioned to Senku, seeing that science is the solution for everything. And I like how they break it down in the show. You know, when one character is not as scientific, so the show will explain, okay, this is how you make, you know, gunpowder, or this is what this particular compound is. And so just given all of that, like, how should Christians view science? You mentioned you yourself are a scientist, and I think there's a lot of times tension for Christians between science and faith. And that's just mainly because, you know, there's a lot of potential, you know, for advancement with science and great good, but also things that for Christians are sometimes, you know, ethical concerns that could do great harm, like, you know, selecting an embryo based on a gender or something like that. So those kinds of tensions that Christians feel, how did you address that?
Yeah, and I liked what you said about the Senku, and throughout the show, there's these little tidbits about the science and all the good that can do. And that's one of the fun things about the show is these little educational moments where Senku sort of takes an aside to sort of tell the audience about, oh, this can be used for this, and all these different like scientific tidbits on how science makes the world a better place, right? And that is one of the things that people love about science, and that I love about science, is all the benefits we've had from science, all the wonderful things it's done, from giving us antibiotics and giving us electricity and all the engineering feats that we can do. It's like there's so many amazing things that science can do that have really improved our lives for the better, right? And then, yeah, on the flip side of that, of course, there is all the harm that science can do. I was doing some reading recently about the chemical company IG Farben back in the 1940s, which is like this very ironic twist of fate that they were the first company to produce antibiotics on a large mass scale. Like really, really ushered in the antibiotic revolution back in the day. That being said, IG Farben was also the same company that manufactured the poison gas used in the Holocaust by the Nazis in their concentration camps. And so like that just to me was like this really quirky irony that you see it so clearly, like the potential dangers and harm that science can do, but also the immense good that it can do in this one company in this one time point in history. And so, yeah, scientists live in that tension. And yeah, it might be confusing to people to say, like, how do we approach this thing then that has so much potential for both great harm and great good? And so I think Christians should start with the realization that science is a tool like any other tool. It's morally neutral, basically, in sort of how it's just a set of principles, right? So the question is then, this morally neutral thing, then what do we do with it? Well, the moment you bring scientists into science, and you have to because science is done by scientists, they aren't morally neutral, right? And so there's this tension there, though, where like we have like, where, like, how does this go? Which direction is science going to take? That's going to be dependent on the scientists and the people who do it and society at large. So I think if we want to see the best that science has to offer, then we should promote good morality, ultimately putting our hope in God and getting our direction from Him about what is the right thing to do, what is right versus wrong, how do we define those things? And if we start from there, then we can know, okay, then how can we use science to promote the good and rein in the bad?
This is kind of like a side question, really, but I'm interested to find out particularly why you decide to become a scientist. I mean, why does someone go into science? Specifically because Christians, you know, as I mentioned earlier, there's this tension between science and faith, and a lot of Christians feel that it's a field that would be very difficult for Christians because you have to hold to macro-Darwinian evolution and all of these, you know, famous scientists who are well known in the culture, like Neil deGrasse Tyson. You know, it's mostly atheists in the field and so forth. So it's just an interesting question, I think, that our listeners would want to know. Why would someone want to pursue science, especially at your level? You said you've been working on your PhD for 5 years.
Yeah. And hopefully I'll be done soon. I've been working a while. So for me personally, I got into science. It's sort of like a long process, I guess. My degree is in molecular biology. So I am in that field. But my interest in biology, like, that just began when I was a kid. And like I would go to the zoo and I would see all the crazy diversity that we have In nature, we see all the, like a giraffe looks so different from an elephant, which looks so different from a seal, which looks extremely different from a tree. And I was just like, wow, this is so many amazing diversity that we see in the biological world in nature. And it's all cool to me. I was just like, there's so much to see, so much to explore and to check out. And I was like, this is so really amazing. And then I got to high school and we learned in high school about genes and about genetics and DNA and the code in every single cell that was driving all of that diversity. And so I was like, man, I really want to study that more and just learn about this code and genetics and how all of that diversity works itself out at the molecular level. And so, yes, that's sort of like what got me into biology specifically. And then for science particularly, when I was in an undergrad, there were several people who influenced me to go get a PhD. My mother actually has a PhD already, so that was a big factor from when I was little. But when I was at university, there was one woman who was very influential, and her name was Dr. Gail Whittier at Binghamton University. And I took her Shakespeare class. And people are so surprised every time I tell them that, when they're like, a Shakespeare class was what got you to do biology? Did you hate Shakespeare that much? And I was like, no, I loved it. But like, she had her PhD in English literature. And so she was able to do something that a humanities PhD would do that someone in the sciences PhD wouldn't necessarily do. And so she broke down like PhD, like its word origin, like its phonetics and everything. And so PhD is Doctor of Philosophy. Doctor originally is from the Latin docere, which means teacher. So it's from the same root word that we get doctrine. And philosophy is two compound Greek words, philosophias, and philo, people might know, or philo, means love, right? From Philadelphia, like one of those four words for love that we have. And then sophias is Greek for wisdom. And so to hear my English teacher in undergrad describe it, a PhD was a teacher of the love of wisdom, someone who was so captivated by their subject, and they just loved it so much that they just had to tell everybody about it and had to keep diving into what was there. And so that's when she described that, I was like, that's how I feel about biology. I just love to talk about it. I love to explore and figure out what's there and find wisdom there in the biological world. And so, yeah, that's how I got personally into it. And I think that's how a lot of people initially get started in science. They're just really invested, really curious, really interested to see what's there about their field. They just love their field so much.
So particularly, you know, for a Christian who's a scientist like yourself, what motivates you to practice science? And how is that different from the approach of the non-Christian scientist, which, as I mentioned earlier, like Neil deGrasse Tyson, so many of these non-Christian scientists have become quite popular in culture and people know who they are and, you know, listen to what they have to say, that really their beliefs that God does not exist informs how they practice science and communicate it to other people.
Yeah. And so, yeah, that's definitely a big thing there. And it's tricky because the actual science that gets done in terms of how it's practiced and how it's worked out, it can look the same, whether the person is a Christian or a non-Christian, right? And so like the actual thing that they publish or present at the scientific conference, whatever, is going to look pretty much the same. But yeah, that motivation though it is going to be very different. And just in my experience, for a lot of scientists, and this is kind of sad, especially in like the academic setting, pride is a big motivator. Academics are some of the most arrogant people that I know, unfortunately. And that's a generalization. There's some gems there too. But yeah, scientists are, there's a large number of people in science who are motivated by the desire for fame and fortune, basically. They're out there to make the big discovery, change the world, and get really famous because of it. And there is sort of like a biblical warrant, I guess, or a biblical like description of that we get from James. And this was like really powerful to me as a scientist, because like I said, the breakdown of Doctor of Philosophy is somebody who is a teacher of the love of wisdom. And so how do we think about wisdom? And James talks a lot about wisdom in his letter. And so in James chapter 3, he has this description in verse 13 who is wise and understanding among you, let them show it by their good life, by deeds done in the humility that comes from wisdom. And so from there, what we see James saying is that our wisdom that we gain, which is ultimately from God, he talks about that in chapter one, but the wisdom that we gain about all things, like in science, we're all about wisdom in science, that is supposed to lead us to humility and lead us to do good deeds and a good life, right? All the wisdom that we're gaining, that's where it's supposed to be going. So that's like the motivation I try to have as the Christian. It's like my wisdom that I'm getting should be shown by my good life, by good deeds, and to humility, realizing that everything I'm learning is from God, right? In the next verse, what James says is, if you harbor bitter envy and selfish ambition in your heart, do not boast about it or deny the truth. Such wisdom does not come down from heaven, but is earthly, unspiritual, and demonic. And unfortunately, I do see a lot of that in specifically academia and the way science is done there, where so much of the wisdom that people are getting is from this position of selfish ambition and bitter envy. And so that is a kind of wisdom that they are getting, but it's earthly, it's spiritual, it's demonic. It's not from the same position that the Christian has of, this is a gift, this is something I'm humbly accepting from God. So that would be like the main difference in motivation, I would say.
You know, you're mentioning your observations in the academic world and scientists who, you know, are envious of others or have a lot of ego as they, you know, approach their discipline. And so what would life be like for that person? It seems like that person is making science itself their God, because you're saying that's what you see with the non-Christian scientists. I mean, what does it actually mean to serve science? Is there a different way that a Christian would approach it than the person who, like you said, has ego and has made, you know, science their religion?
Yeah. So it's, when I look at that, when I see these people who have sort of made science their religion, like, it does make me sad, because like we said earlier, science is simply a set of principles for how we do observation and form hypotheses, right? So if you're going to make science your God, you're making this set of principles like your end all be all. And that science, like, science doesn't like care about you one way or the other. It's not something that can respond to you like a person. It's just a philosophical outlook. So if you want to throw yourself into like making science your God and serving science the way I've seen several academic students pour their entire life into their science, and that's just all that they consume their life with. And I'm just like, I feel very sad for that, because their science is not going to respond to them with anything. If they are good and they're good scientists and they, you know, maybe they will make a great discovery that maybe will shape humanity, but the ultimate like reward for that, like, science could just as easily give them nothing. And a lot of times that's what happens. A lot of times we pour a lot of our energy and effort into experiments that go nowhere, or that we make a wrong interpretation about and end up, all of our results are false. This happens quite often in science, where scientists are wrong quite often. And so you can pour yourself into that and you have no guarantee that you're going to get anything out of it. And so I really do feel sad for people who put all of their energy and their effort into the science, because they might, science could, you know, maybe like Senku, maybe you could end up pouring all yourself into science and then that could get you killed, and science doesn't care one way or the other.
So that's really interesting, because in this anime, Dr. Stone, I mean, definitely Senku does serve science, and he just kind of has that kind of superiority when he's trying to explain how different things work and why that we need them and why science is so valuable. And then other characters respond to him just by saying, oh yes, you're so brilliant. You know what, you know, his good friend that was one of the other people that he had been alive a little bit longer than his friend who became revived. Yeah. And so every time anything was happening, you know, because he was, like you said, the brawn, then Senku would say, well, here's what, you know, science can do. Here's how science can help us restore this world. And there's always this marvel about how amazing science is from that other character. And so, you know, from a human perspective, you know, our scientific discoveries obviously are valuable, but are they always 100% valuable? Because it really, in this anime, it seems like it puts science on this pedestal, like it has all the answers. It's like even in a primitive society, he's trying to, you know, go forward millions of years of all this scientific, or thousands of years of all the scientific discovery, and then this new world, you know, take his knowledge and just bring things that hadn't happened in regular human history before this event that took so long, because science is so amazing.
Yeah. So yeah, from like a human perspective, yeah, we do tend to give value to some discoveries over other. And that's sort of like, yeah, a lot of people are, they are driven for that major discovery, right? If you look at the Nobel Prize, the medal that we give to all the best discoveries, right, on the back, there's an inscription that loosely translates to "they who bettered life on Earth by their newly found mastery." And that's a quote from Virgil's Aeneid. And so discoveries that better life on Earth are the valuable ones, right? And yeah, like sort of like what Senku does. He's like trying to find those discoveries to help along civilization and get it back to before the stone world came into being. And so, yeah, and so even today, science that as it's practiced in industry or in academia or at the government level, like it's all trying to find the ones, those discoveries that will get us the next big discovery and help people out, right? And that's sort of tricky too, because it's like we're spending so much money. Science is big industry. We use billions and billions of dollars in industry and all these other spending places. There's so much money that goes into it. And so when you're pouring all that money onto something, like you have to have a way to justify it in some way. And so because it's such a big industry as well, scientists are encouraged to work on questions that are expected to benefit humanity. And the problem with that is that so many discoveries in science have been totally serendipitous, like totally accidental almost, where nobody was really looking for it. It just kind of got dropped in our lap, some might say providentially. I like to say providentially. And then somebody at the right time was able to realize what was happening, and they made this great discovery, right? And so we can't accurately predict what the next big discovery will be or where it's going to come from. And so, but even though we value those scientific discoveries that advance civilization, it's something that I think we can't be too proud about, because so many of them have been providential and we weren't really looking for it. Even though there have been plenty that we can see the logic behind it.
So just thinking about, like you said, some of these scientific discoveries aren't always necessarily planned. It's been something providential. How would a Christian scientist approach, you know, their research? How do they glorify God as they practice science?
Yeah, great question. So I would say that for the Christian scientists like that, it does present sort of like the question, like, can a Christian like even like practice science? And I believe they can, because I think that's what I do. And so you have to start by realizing that like it's impossible for you to serve both God and science as Lord, right? Like you have to, like, as the Christian, God is your Lord, not your science, right? But that being said, yeah, the scientist can still glorify God with their work. And I think one of the ways that scientists glorify God is by displaying his creativity. So as creatures created in the image of God, scientists reflect God's creativity by their work. Science is an incredibly creative process. We get thousands of new ideas coming out of labs every single year. And I see that as all a testimony to the God-given creative power that humans possess. And so I think that's really cool. And I also think that scientists, there's a few other ways that they can glorify God, and that is using science to bring healing to those suffering the effects of a broken world. So either by discovering medications or building wells, all the different wonderful things that science gives us to address suffering. And because we know God cares about suffering, he cares about the broken people in the world. And so I think reaching out in love with the wisdom that we have from science to help other people is a way that scientists can glorify God. And the tricky thing behind that, though, is that you don't have to be a Christian specifically to do those two things I just described. You don't have to be a Christian specifically to be creative or use your science to help people, right? Those are things that people do, whether they're Christian or not, right? Senku does that, and he's clearly not a Christian in the anime. But I think there is a way that a scientist can glorify God as a Christian specifically. And this glory to God comes when we clearly display to other people that God is our ultimate treasure, our ultimate one that we go to, the one that we put all of our hope and trust in the midst of failure. So one of like the thrilling things about doing science is that there's often like really cool discoveries that happen, but there's no guarantee that you're going to find something really amazing. Like I said earlier, so much of what we do in science results in failure. The hypothesis didn't work. We didn't get the vaccine or whatever it is we're trying to do. And it's like, there's a lot of failure that happens. In my PhD program, students are told to work on multiple projects simultaneously for their dissertations because it's expected that they're not going to all work. So I think that when failure comes to us as scientists in the form of like our unsuccessful experiment or disappointing data or rejected paper, how we respond to that is a way to glorify God. So if we respond by worrying about our future or worrying about our graduation, or if we respond by pulling ourselves up by our ego, you know, trying to convince ourselves that we are really the ones who are going to solve this, and this is just a bump in the road, but we're going to be the ones to get there with the next experiment. Like, that doesn't bring glory to God. But for the Christian, when things don't go as planned in our lives, we look to God, right? We look to God as the source of our strength, and we rest in his promises, and we can rejoice even in the midst of terrible circumstances and when things don't go our way, because we have the love of God, we have forgiveness in Christ, and we can rest that our security is ultimately in him, even in the midst of when things don't go our way and when things don't go the way we'd planned. So I think that is one of the ways that I've recently been focusing on, and like how I can glorify God in the lab by showing people that these experiments, these things, these are not my ultimate security. These are not my ultimate plans, but it's God. He has my future. He has my back, and I'm his child.
What are some practical ways that we can make sure that science doesn't become an idol in our own lives? Because that can happen for the Christian too, right? You know, it seems like if we want to know something very definitive, if there's facts that we want to know, well, we think, well, science will answer that for us. And putting our hope in science to solve all the world's problems, or maybe even our own personal problems, whether they, you know, if especially if they're like some medical issue we face, how do we not look to science as, you know, the thing that's going to be the savior for us?
Yeah, totally. That's a great question. And yeah, the temptation, like you said, is totally there. And I get that being so much in this. And yeah, I think we've seen a lot of that with just the whole current coronavirus pandemic. And I've seen like, there's the tension of like people talking about like, do we like science is going to get us out of this? The vaccine is going to be what we're going to put our hope in and our faith in. And I'm totally, for the record, I'm supportive of the vaccines. And I do think the science is sound on that. But at the same time, I realize that like, even though science can get us amazing things like vaccines and treatments for COVID and all the things that we can do and that we have because of what science has given us, ultimately, I know that my trust belongs in Christ and that God is the one who runs the universe and who will determine the outcome of my life, right? And like, I think it's good for people to remember that even in the face of all the good that science has given us, there's still so much that it can't. And that so much of the last century with World War I, World War II, and like people were coming right out of one of the worst, bloodiest periods in human history, which was also at the cusp of like a huge advance in technology on all fronts. And so people, they saw that like, oh my gosh, there's so much like harm that science can do, even though there's so much good it can bring, and science has no control over the human heart. And there is someone though who can heal our hearts, who can give us that ultimate security, and who does run the world, and that's Christ. So I would say for the Christian, like, science, yes, super useful, so many wonderful things that come from it. It is appropriate that we listen to scientists and we listen to what science says to understand the world that we live in. think that's totally appropriate, but we also should understand that the world that we live in is run by God, and we should submit to him and trust in him ultimately.
Well, finally, on another note, I have some fun rapid-fire questions for Harrison. So, Harrison, what's your favorite meal?
Favorite meal? Pasta. I eat a lot of pasta.
Introvert or extrovert?
I am probably an introvert. There is another category, I think, called ambivert that people can look up if they want. I would probably call myself an ambivert, but I guess the only options are introvert or extrovert. Introvert.
Yes, I've given you very binary options there.
Sorry.
Early bird or night owl?
I'm night owl, yeah.
Who is your favorite scientist in history?
Ooh, favorite scientist in history. Oh, man. Wow, there's so many. Right now, probably Vincent Racaniello, because I've been listening to all of his podcast episodes, who's a virologist over in Columbia University. But, man, that's so tough. Yeah, we'll just say Vincent Racaniello for now. I hope he appreciates that.
And are you highly organized or spontaneous and go with the flow?
Oh, I like to be organized. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which is why I like to have spontaneous friends, because they break me out of that sometimes.
Well, thanks, Harrison, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This was great.
You've been listening to episode 246 of the Postmodern Realities podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest was Harrison Dunlin, who wrote a print article for our Postmodern Realities column in Volume 44, Number 2, print issue of the Christian Research Journal. His article is called Martyr of Science, a reflection on the anime Dr. Stone. And you can read his article when you subscribe to the Christian Research Journal at equip.org. We'd like to connect to you, so please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man YouTube channel and join in the conversation in the comments section and in the live chat when we have premiere videos. Please follow the Bible Answer Man page on Facebook and on Twitter. You will find us at Hank Hanegraaff, Bible Answer Man, Christian Research Institute, and Christian Research Journal, as well as on Instagram at the Bible Answer Man account. You won't want to miss every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern when we live stream the Bible Answer Man broadcast, hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff at our website, equip.org. In addition, please subscribe to the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank gets out of the studio and into his study and engages in in-depth, free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. You'll want to head on over to equip.org because there you're going to find thousands of free resources for you in articles and past broadcasts, our podcasts, and videos. And thank you for all the ways in which you partner with the Christian Research Institute.